This is Limitless Possibility. I'm Yannick Mayan.
And I'm Luc-Olivier Dumablet.
And our topic this week is...
the current state of streaming services.
Okay, before we get into that, we have some follow-up, and I'm going to start with my follow-up. First of all, this isn't related to any episode in particular, but recently I went to the Apple Store in Quebec City, and I tried to hold the iPhone 6 Plus, and immediately the first thing I did was drop it. And then I put it back on the stand and never touched it again. So that is my review of the iPhone 6 Plus.
Your review of the iPhone 6 Plus is dropping it in the Apple Store.
Yes. That should tell you everything you need to know about the iPhone 6 Plus. Next up, we have...
you honestly need to see my face right now.
Mm-hmm. Next up is a correction from my mom about Bill 101. Last time we talked about, I mentioned how in Quebec you need to have one of your parents go to English school in order to be eligible to go to English school yourself. And apparently it's not just your parents, it can also be grandparents. So if your parents decided not to go to English school, if your grandparents went, you can bring a paper proving that they went to English school and get into English school yourself, which is neat, I guess. Doesn't solve the problem for everyone, though.
But I guess it might be hard to get proof that your grandparents went to an English school.
I don't know. Next up, I have a lot of mobile payments follow-up for episode 2. If you haven't heard that episode, it was the episode where I went into Apple Pay and mobile payments in Japan. First of all, in that episode, I mentioned that there was a possibility that you could use Suica cards, which are train cards in Japan, to make purchases on the new Nintendo 3DS, which has not come out in the West yet. I bought a game this week using Suica on the new 3DS because a system update came out that made it possible. And in the show notes, you can find a vine of me buying Mighty Gunvolt for 300 yen on the eShop with my Suica card. So that's follow-up number one. Follow-up number two. Apple Pay news that came out today. Apple Pay now supports the cards that make up to 90% of credit card purchases in the U.S. So this is tremendous progress for Apple Pay in the U.S. as far as credit card adoption has gone. So now, chances are probably your credit card, if you are in the U.S., is supported by Apple Pay, which is interesting. Next up, Google Wallet, which we touched on a bit during that episode. They had an update for iOS today. That update now supports Touch ID, which is strange. It's not exactly like Apple Pay, where you use Touch ID to pay, but it's rather you can use Touch ID to authenticate with the app when you're launching it, and then you can use it to do transactions sort of like on PayPal, like sending money from one person to another, or Venmo, those kinds of services. So that came out today.
It seems to me that using the Touch ID functionality the same way as 1Password is using it right now. Like, just to unlock your account. That's it.
Yeah, that's it. But it's a lot more convenient than typing in a PIN number every time you do it. So
yeah, that's right.
Cool. And last but not least, so there are two venture capitalists out there called Keith Rabois and Semil Shah, I believe is his name. And they've been doing a series of weekly discussions on YouTube called Sunday Conversations, and last weekend they had one on Apple Pay, and it is the best 7-minute conversation on Apple Pay I have ever heard, so you should probably go listen to it. It explains very clearly why Apple Pay is a big deal compared to other mobile payment services that have come out in the past, and you can find that in our show notes. So to cut you have some follow-up of your own.
Yep, I do have two items on my list. The first one is, as some people might know, I have follow-up related to my last episode, which is was feelings about the way I use my iPad. My follow-up related to that is last episode was posted using some kind of workflow and iPad apps. Yay! Problem is, I broke something.
What did you break?
I did break the show notes inside the the RSS feed.
Oh.
Yeah. So some people might have seen to-do as show notes, which is, yeah. But now, at least I found a way to show to get the HTML version of Markdown text from editorial. So at least I will be able to just do that next time and do that copy and paste. And the next item is more a question to you, and it's related to your trip to Boston.
Yeah, so I went to Boston last week and took the Japanese language proficiency test.
Yep, so was the test?
I don't really know. Things that I thought would be easy ended up being hard, and things that I thought would be hard ended up being easy, so I have absolutely no idea how well it went, which is sort of worrying. But overall, the difficulty level was about what I was expecting. The problem is I wasn't prepared at all for it. Like, I was prepared for it to be that difficult, but I was not prepared to do well on it. That is what I mean.
And do you know when you'll receive your grade?
As a beginning of February, I believe.
Oh, that's a pretty long wait.
Yeah. So maybe on season 2 we'll have follow up on my JLPT results. I expect to fail, really. Realistically, I don't think there's any way I can pass. It was still a really interesting test to take, like, just to get a feel for what it's like. And at the very least, the texts you had to read for reading comprehension were actually fairly interesting, so that's good.
That's nice. So at least you might have a failing party while you're in Japan, like celebrating the fact that you failed your exam.
Yeah, well, the problem is, like, my Japanese friends, they are a little bit too positive, and I don't think they realize, like, I don't think they know what the N2 level actually entails, so that doesn't help. But B, they seem to overestimate my Japanese skill a lot just because we can communicate as well as we do in person. But I don't think they realize that my Japanese learning isn't quite as balanced as they think it is.
Huh. Maybe they will be able to help you this year.
I don't really plan on studying much with them while I'm there.
Let's call studying being with friends in a bar drinking.
Oh, well, there's going to be a lot of that. Okay, so next up, we have a small segment on video games, which might actually be a recurring topic if this keeps up.
Yeah, but it's pretty nice to have just a small topic before the big one. So, funny enough, it won't be about the fact that I bought a PS3, because I did not.
You said PS3, but you meant PS4.
Yeah, PS4, of course. Yeah, and small about the PS4 is I wanted to buy a 20th anniversary PS4 this morning, because the Sony announced the pre-order for it for Canada this morning, and it sold out in 10 minutes. And I was sadly 10 minutes late for it.
That's nice.
Yeah, that's nice. But whatever. So I guess I'll get a PS4 later this year. But something I wanted to talk about is...
Wait. You said later this year. That means 2014, right? That means before the end of the year, right?
Let's just say 2015 then. Yep. So, I was about to start talking about another console that Yannick suggested me to buy a couple of months ago, which is the Nintendo 3DS. And the main reason why I bought a 3DS is I'm a big fan of the Ace Attorney series on the Nintendo DS. And the latest release in that series is Professor Layton vs. Phoenix Wright Ace Attorney. So it's mostly a mix of both popular franchises on those Nintendo portable consoles. You have Ace Attorney that's made by Capcom, and the Professor Layton series that is made by Level 5. And if you want a small explanation of both kind of game, like, Ace Attorney is more of like adventure visual novel kind of game. So you're an attorney and you have enigmas to resolve, and you go to the court and you try to save your client, and most of the time you do save it, and all of the time you save a client, because you have perfect clients that are always innocent, which is never true. And that game was my first experience with the Professor Layton game, so it's pretty neat. the Prophet Solitaire games mostly focus on adventure and puzzle solving. So most of the time there's a small story related to around like people will save the world, quote unquote, by solving puzzles, which is kind of funny and all that stuff. So the latest game mixed both genres, and they have kind of a good story around it, and the way that they mix both series is pretty nice, is pretty neat. And I would say that if you have a couple of minutes per day, and if you want to spend some pretty great money during this Christmas time to buy a Nintendo 3DS game, I would strongly suggest you to buy that game. And I know, Yannick, that you played to the Japanese version, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, so I got the Japanese version for very cheap because it was a flop in Japan. So I got to get it for actually like $20, I think, which is really, really good for an import game since normally they go for like three times that.
Wow, that's strange because it's really an awesome game.
Well, it didn't do very well with Ace Attorney series fans in Japan because Ace Attorney's fans wanted more Ace Attorney and less Professor Layton, and I guess there are more Ace Attorney fans than Professor Layton in the people who reviewed it, so it sort of skewed that way and it got negative perception. I actually really, really like this game, except, and this is bordering on spoilery, but it's on the back of the box, I'm pretty sure, so it should be okay. The game takes place in a magical world. And, well, when you have a magical world, you can throw a lot of things out the window with regards to logic and, like, realism. So things that you would expect wouldn't fly in the real world. Well, maybe not literally flying, but figuratively, but also literally sometimes. They are possible in this world, and that can throw you for a loop, but it's also intended to throw you for a loop in the story. So it's not like you're screwed because you're like, well, this thing is magic and it screwed me. It's like, it's intended in the story to screw you, but you're like, okay, well, it would have been fun to actually know this beforehand.
No, but it's pretty funny because it's like, it's even if it's also a magic world, it's a medieval world also. And Phoenix is thrown away by that because at some point, there's no spoiler about what that quote, but at some point, Phoenix wanted to do a blood analysis, and everybody looks at him with, what? Blood analysis?
Yeah.
And then you realize, like, oh, right, we're in a medieval world, so some of those reflexes that you have for the normal Ace Attorney series don't work in that game.
Yeah, which is a little unfortunate, because, like, I like those sort of mini-games. On the other hand, it's a great introduction to the Layton series. I'm actually fairly curious about playing the Layton games now because of it. I think the art direction and the music in the game is fantastic, which normally it is on Phoenix Wright games.
It is normally, but I would say that the last one, which was Phoenix Wright 5, there was some kind of strange music choice that I didn't like. For example, like when you won a case, it was like a small clip looping and you could find where it was looping. And every time I won a case, I was like, jeez, stop playing that music.
I have like the memory of that being the case for the older games too. It's just that it wouldn't loop as long maybe. But it would still be a very short loop. Like, that's sort of typical of that kind of thing. What I do want to point out, though, is that the artistic choices are very much more, I believe, to be level 5 influence. If you actually like the level 5 aesthetic and you are familiar with their games, you will really like the visual and audio feel of this game. It's really, really good. But again, like that's part of the reason it flopped kind of in Japan, because Ace Attorney fans didn't want a level 5 game. They wanted an Ace Attorney game, and it's sort of weird that it would flop because of that. But if you want like a slightly different take on the Ace Attorney series, it is worth checking out, I believe, especially if you can grab it for cheap. I believe in the US it's only available on the eShop, right?
No, I have a physical.
No, wait. I'm thinking of the other one.
Yeah, the Phoenix Wright 5 is only on the eShop.
Right.
But yeah, that logic of that game being a level 5 focus game, mostly being a Professor Layton focus game throw me a little bit away. Like when I was beginning him, and then I discovered the Professor Layton series through that game, and it like tinkered with my curiosity. I was like, maybe I should go see what's the other 3DS game for the from Professor Layton. And maybe that's what I'm going to buy to replace my 20th anniversary PS4.
Actually, here's the most concise definition I can make of this game. You take an Ace Attorney game, then you take all of the crime scene investigation stuff, and you replace it with Professor Layton, and that's what you get.
Yep, that's a pretty good summary of it.
Yeah, and I believe this is true for at least the first half of the game, but they alternate chapters, sort of like we do with our show, where every second chapter is the alternate point of view. So one chapter will be Professor Layton, the other will be Phoenix Wright, and it keeps switching back until their paths intertwine at a certain point around midway through the game. And it's unfortunate that talking about this game for many things involves spoiling it, so we can't really go into too much detail.
Yeah, that's why most of my notes is mostly like, what's the genre of the game? Who's the developer of the game? And stuff around the game.
Basically,
not about its content.
If you like either series, you should check it out. But you probably have checked it out if you are a fan of either series. If you are not familiar with either series, but you are intrigued by the idea of a puzzle slash adventure slash visual novel mishmash, then you should probably check it out. And you can probably get it for cheap because it was, I don't know about here, but at least in Japan, it was a flop.
Yeah, here in Canada, it was around $35. So it's pretty the normal price.
Yeah. But it's also newer here because it's like 2 years old in Japan.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's move on to our main topic.
Yep. So this week I wanted to start to talk about the current state of streaming services. And these days there's a lot of news and there's a lot of debates related to them. But before we start, I wanted to make a small history of why those services were created in the first place. And to do that, we need to jump back at the beginning of the 2000s. So at that point, let's call it the digital boom started with the CD and people and CD and the MP3 players. And at that point, it was really hard to have access to like big formats. And what I want to mean by big format is visual format. So it was really hard to get over the internet high quality video or high quality movies, TV shows. And that's why at that time the music format boomed. And people wanted to put music on those MP3 players. But the only way to get music at that point was via CDs. So there was two solutions to face that problem. The first one was to rip CDs, which is pretty straightforward solution. And the other one is to go on the internet and find some nice software, let's call it that way, to get bytes from other people, whatever the bytes is. And here what I'm trying to say is obviously all of those piracy software like Napster, Nutella, LimeWire, Kazaa, BitTorrent, whatever. And when I was younger, I mostly use all of those. And yeah, so those software were, I'm sure most people kind of use at least one of those. But if you're a nice person and you are like staying away from piracy, I will just explain the logic behind most of those software. So most of them were based on decentralized stuff. I think Napster was based on centralized server, if I recall correctly.
Yes, it was.
Yeah. Okay. So everything except Napster and was decentralized. So people were hosting files on their machine and the software was used to share those files on your machine to somebody else around the world and make them available easily. without a need of a centralized server, meaning without a need to have one person to point when there's a problem with piracy. So at that point, the level of piracy was really, really high. And then the music industry and a big company that you might know, which is called Apple, decided to jump on that problem and trying to find a solution. And Yannick, can you guess which software was that solution?
iTunes.
Yes.
Wow. I was trying to remember the name of the software that it's based on, but I can't remember.
Oh, wow. That's a good one.
SoundJam.
Yes, SoundJam. And do you remember when iTunes came out?
Well, I'm cheating because I'm looking at the show notes, but...
Yeah, but that's not the iTunes launch date. That's the iTunes Music Store launch date.
No, the actual iTunes launched in early 2001.
Good. And the iTunes Music Store, as you just said, was launched in April 2003 in the US and here in Canada in December 2004. So the gist of the iTunes Music Store was to give an opportunity to give an easy way for people to download music. And because the main problem related to those software, piracy software, was they were hard to use. They provided you a cheap way to get music, but the experience was bad.
Well, for a second, I just want to say, like, the experience was bad. I would actually argue that Napster in particular was actually very good with regards to user experience. It's just that, well, unfortunately, in quotes, it was centralized, so it was easy to be shut down. But the user experience for Napster was really good. The other ones were really crap, but people were willing to put up with it because they were getting free stuff. Whereas otherwise, if they actually wanted to do the legal thing, they had to get in their car and drive to an HMV or something and buy a CD. And that is actually less convenient for people than putting up with this terrible software on their computer that probably has malware in it somehow.
Yeah, and the main reason was because their PCs, not Mac. So most of them were, like, easy infectable.
Well, Macs in those days weren't really perfect either, but...
Okay. Yeah, I was not saying they were perfect. Just saying that...
They were low visibility targets, especially in the early 2000s.
Exactly. So most people were using Windows 2000 or Windows XP at that time. And everyone know that Windows XP had a perfect record at that point. Not, but yeah. So if we come back at iTunes, like, after music, iTunes introduced the podcast directory in June 2005, and I'm sure most of our listeners found us on iTunes, let's hope. And at that point, iTunes realized that, I guess Apple realized that internet connection were going faster and faster, and they saw that on the piracy side, people were started to download movies, TV shows. And guess what? They did the same. So they added the TV show section in October 2005, and they added the movie section in September 2006 to stay up with popularity of those format in piracy services. Because we need to not forget something related to that. Before piracy era, is people were buying CDs, and most of those CDs or vinyls were like $15, $20, $25. And most people were buying them for like 3 or 4 songs, because there was those 3 or 4 popular songs on them. So record labels, artists were making tons of money because of that. Obviously more record labels than artists, but yet the proportions still stay the same. At that point, people really loved iTunes, but they started to have a problem with some feature in iTunes that was enforced to Apple. And the one I'm referring to is DRM. As you may know, like, right now, all of the songs that you buy on iTunes are DRM-free.
That's not actually true in all regions, by the way.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I can't say 100% which ones are still DRM'd, but I know that even like a few years ago, there were certain Japanese record labels that said, sorry, if you want to sell our stuff, you have to continue to sell it DRM'd. So on the iTunes Japanese store, there were certain record labels whose content was only available DRM.
And I guess those record labels were not available here in the US because Apple wanted to keep their DRM-free tag on the iTMS store US version.
Actually, it's just like record labels in general in Japan don't really like their music getting out outside of the country, it seems. So that's probably why you never saw it outside of Japan. And I wouldn't put it past Apple to just say, well, if you're going to be like that, well, just stay in your domestic market and you won't get any money outside of there.
Good. Before I jump to the streaming services and their current state, I wanted to know which feature of iTunes you were using the most at that time.
You mean with regards to the store?
Yes, and like, were you more a person that was ripping CDs still, or you were mostly using the store, or something else?
So at that time, I was mostly downloading music off BitTorrent. I have since stopped doing that, but in the early 2000s, I was mostly just getting all my music off of BitTorrent, full albums always, because it feels dirty to have incomplete albums, and it still does to a bit, which is why I don't buy much off of the iTunes store, because it's tempting for me to just buy the full album. And in many cases, I don't want the full album, but I still feel incomplete if I don't have the full album. So it's CD mentality. I never escaped CD mentality. In fact, I still have, like, my desk is covered in CDs from this year. So,
and why is that? Why are you still buying CDs?
Because I'm a big fan of Japanese music that is independently published at, like, they have quarterly events. Like, there's M3 and there's Komike that's coming up, which is where independent artists will just sell their CDs that they've printed themselves to other people. Sometimes it's even on CDRs even. And they'll just sell them to people, which is really, really nice. But the problem is, as a foreigner, I have to, like, bully one of my friends into going there for me and buying CDs, which is sort of like uncomfortable because I have to do it like every 3 months if I want to have the music that I want. And like, there's a certain album I've been trying to get for 6 months, and I've had 2 chances to get it, and every time my friend gets there a little too late and they're all sold out. So like, I still don't have that CD, and it's a real pain. And I really wish every artist on the planet would embrace Bandcamp, and maybe we'll talk about that later, I don't know. But I love how Bandcamp works, and I wish every Japanese indie artist would just jump on that, because it's the best thing I've used.
Yep, and for myself, at that time, I was mostly using LimeWire and Kazaa. First started on Kazaa, because it was popular here in Quebec. And then everybody, all of my friends, moved to LimeWire. And then I kind of started buying music a little bit while still downloading stuff off of BitTorrent. But for most of my friends, BitTorrent was really hard.
Go ahead.
Which was really funny, because I remember hating LimeWire so much, because it, like, for me, it was way, way, way more complex as a UI perspective. Like, it seems to me that, like, trying to find stuff was hard. The, like, sorting in the list was weird. And on BitTorrent and on BitTorrent clients, you just go to some website, type what you want, and everyone, at that point, mostly everybody knew how to do a proper website that has a proper search functionality. So at that point, you just go on the website, click on the link, and then you download the torrent file, and voila, after a couple of minutes or hours, you add an album.
Yeah. One of the things I wanted to mention is I have very good memories of early 2000s using Hotline for peer-to-peer, which you probably have never heard of.
What's that?
Yeah, so there was Hotline, and there was another peer-to-peer thing, which I can't remember, which was basically a clone of Hotline, but it was Mac only. Hotline is basically, you probably don't know the other one, too, that I don't remember the name of. I believe it was First Class or something. Basically, it was old BBS software, and except it was adapted to work on the internet. So you could log into these BBSs that people made that had file sharing sections, and it was really popular on the Mac for piracy stuff in the early 2000s, late 90s. It was more so for software piracy than for music piracy, but there were like file shares with a bunch of crazy shit on there. And I have a lot of memories of that too, but that was less me and more my dad.
Good. And now that we talked about all of those piracy software, I guess the question is, do you still use those? I can say that I don't.
No. So I think it was 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, when I started like really doing my job full time. Piracy isn't really right and doesn't feel right when like you yourself are impacted by piracy on a daily basis. Like, I'm fairly sure that the amount of copies, I don't actually have piracy tracking in Iconoclasm. I should probably do it, but I'm pretty sure like it's normal on iOS, especially for jailbroken stuff, for there to be 10 times more pirate users than there are actually legitimate ones. And like, yeah, some of those are people who are going to be people who never would have bought my app in the first place. But like, some of those are genuinely lost sales, and it doesn't feel right to me that they basically don't have to pay to get what I'm selling. And it shouldn't be any different for any other kind of media that I myself consume. So that's basically why, I believe it was 2 or 3 years ago, I basically threw out my entire iTunes library, ripped all the CDs I had, and re-downloaded all the iTunes music I had and started from scratch again. And it also meant that I had like zero unplayed tracks because I could listen to them as they went in. So I had much more appreciation for the music that I actually bought than I would have otherwise.
Yeah, that's true. That's something I need to say, that I haven't done that. So somewhere on my hard drive, an external hard drive, I still have my iTunes library, which still contains that stuff. But I can tell you that the main reason why I still open iTunes on my computer is to go to the iTunes store, because I clicked on some link on Safari and it's like popping it up, because of course there still is no web browser for that. But putting that aside, I stopped pirating music around 2010, I would say.
Basically when Spotify came out.
Yes, that's what happened mostly for me. I had like a noble evolution. So like, I stopped pirating music. At that point, I was mostly buying music via iTunes, but I wasn't buying music that much because I'm not. I love music, but I'm not a big music consumer. And what happened with Spotify is, the second I joined Spotify, I stopped buying music. I was just using Spotify. I honestly, these days, I don't remember the last time I bought music on iTunes.
Taylor Swift is very disappointed in you.
I know. And I guess that's the main reason why I decided to speak about that subject. Because as Yannick know, but as you may not know, I don't know why. But first, I don't know why. First of all, I do really love Taylor's music. But I don't know why, but it seems to me that her albums is always my let's focus music.
And it's true for me, too. Like, during college, I was on Spotify. Ironically, I've only listened to Taylor Swift's music on Spotify. But, like, during exams or whatever, I would listen to Taylor Swift's music and, like, there are certain songs that I can't listen to anymore because it makes me think of Oracle databases too much. sorry, Taylor. I don't mean to make that association. But yeah, I really like her music, but I've only listened to it through Spotify.
Yeah, same here. And another artist I can like put on that box is Hilary Duff. Oh my god, I listened to her so much during like database exams.
Everybody makes fun of me for liking Hilary Duff, but she's actually really good.
She is. She is. But sadly, she's kind of like run away from the music industry.
Yeah, she married a hockey player and then we never saw her again.
Yeah, maybe that's better for her.
Maybe.
Yeah, so as some people, as some of you may know, Taylor Swift made a big fuzz at the beginning of November. Beginning of November, when she decided, before launching her latest album, to just... No, it, like, her latest album was released. And she just decided to never put it on streaming services, especially on Spotify. And after that, she decided to remove all of her old albums from Spotify.
And I believe her albums are still available on other streaming services that are not Spotify. The distinct difference between them is that Spotify offers a free tier, and I believe the other ones don't.
Yeah, that's strange, because I always remember that radio adds free tier, but maybe remove it a while ago.
It's possible. Like, remember that they had video too, and they shut that down really fast.
They add video?
Yeah, it was VDIO. It was their video version of RDO.
Right, and they use the same trick. Right, the same name. All right. So, first of all, that part seems really strange to me. Like, if you don't like streaming services, just remove your music from all of those streaming services. And I will say that the main problem with streaming services in general, especially music ones, is there's good argument on both camps. Like, I want to give more money to the artists, while I want to have an easy way to get music. And that's what, like, the main argument Spotify is giving us right now is, and they have a nice page on their website. Obviously, it's like they are trying to sell us stuff. Like, they are trying to sell us their idea about what is Spotify and what they want to do with it. But on the Spotify, which is called Spotify Explain, they explain how they pay artists. And I always assumed that they paid artists per stream. And I'm sure everybody assumed that. But they have kind of a weird ratio that I will try to explain, but go in the show notes and you'll find that link and you'll have the proper explanation. But the gist of it is, they use the number of streams compared to the number of total stream, and they rank you as an artist as on a popularity scale, and then put a ratio on that, and then it should give an average of 0.006 or $0.082 per stream. That's the average that they have these days. And then, like, I always found myself to be a big proponent, like, being like really being a Spotify lover. And then I decided, let's do the math. Spotify is 9.99 euros for me. I'll be back on that, why is euros and not Canadian dollars. But sadly, Spotify don't have a public way to show you your play counts. And thanks to me, and thanks to the fact that I stick to Last.fm, I was able to get my play count for this year. And my play count is 2,073 plays, which roughly equals to $15. Yeah. So I played 2,000 songs in a year, which I think it's not that much. Like, I would say, like, I would imagine, like, I know some of my friends that listen, like, music for, like, 5 hours a day, which is not my case. I would think that with around 2,000 plays for a year, I will be able to give more money to the artist. But with 2,000 plays, I paid an album to 60 to 70 artists. Like, if you take the number of artists I listen to and, like, do the calculation for it.
And that's not even to the artist directly. That's to the artist and record label. And surprise, the record label takes a major part of that.
Exactly. Of course, I did the top 10 of my artists. And the first one is, like we said, is Taylor Swift at 323, which accounts to $2.33.
Wow, she's getting so rich from you.
Exactly. And I won't go through all the numbers, but yeah, that's it. Like, the top five is around $2 per artist. And it's, like, those numbers blow me away. And I'm still like, what? Like, I can't understand those artists, like those big artists that are trying to defend the smaller ones and trying to defend their art in a way.
Yeah, and like big touring artists, like I want to say American artists will usually make maybe an album a year, maybe every 2 years. But even then, like if they sell one $16 album instead of getting $4 over their 2 years, like they'd rather be getting that money, especially since they're getting a tiny proportion of that.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm sure they are more happy to get those touring ticket money than streaming money or album money. And maybe,
yeah,
maybe that's part of the maybe that's part of the solution. And what makes me mostly sad about it, because in a way you can see programming as a kind of art. And if you see the normal type of art being like commoditized, I would say.
Commoditized.
Yeah, commoditized, pardon me. But at that level, to be commoditized, like, what's going to happen with the rest of it? Like, what is going to happen with movies? What is going to happen with books? What is going to happen with comics? With
the same thing.
Yes. And it makes me sad. It honestly makes me sad. And I guess that's the main issue we can see with, for example, if we jump to the video side of things with Netflix. And that's the biggest issue that Netflix is facing, is the movie and TV industry saw what happened with the music industry. And they honestly don't want it to happen to them. But before I jump to movie, I just wanted to put a note about why I'm paying 9.99 euros and not Canadian dollars. As some might know, and some lucky people might be, Spotify launched way back. I think they launched in 2009-2010, mostly in Europe. They recently launched in the US, I think a year ago. And I started to be a premium user in January 2011. So I honestly found a way to be in and all that stuff. So that's why my account is still a European account. And the Canadian were lucky to get Spotify this September. So at least there's a way to stream good music in Canada and have the biggest catalog, I would say. Because I don't know the right, like, I know that radio has a big catalog, but compared to Spotify, I would say they are pretty equal. Maybe Spotify is a bit bigger.
Well, you and I aren't really well placed to comment on the size of the catalog because we have special accounts that have access to the world catalog.
Don't say that. That's
listeners, you didn't hear that, but we have an account.
Yeah. That's maybe part of the problem, but yes. So that's a small parenthesis related to my nice account on Spotify.
Want to talk about video?
After music, I'm like,
you're not sure if you want to keep going.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm honestly not sure. And here I'm only speaking about the service I use, which is Spotify and Netflix. And I included YouTube on it. Because I watch a lot of, like, channels, YouTube channel.
Really?
That's a lot, but most of them are car related.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, and some are big, like the Top Gear channel, and some are small, like Indie channel that started a while ago, but they're still small channel with maybe 5 or 6 people in them. And one of them is called TFL Car.
Yeah.
For the fast lane car. And they started recently to do a Patreon.
Mm-hmm.
And they, like, that's the new way to make them bigger. Because they always tell us during their video that, like, money from the ads is kind of nothing.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Videos, whilst I'm still depressed about that's. Yeah, so like I said before going back to Spotify, the big issue with the video industry is they don't want it to happen. Like, they don't want to make the same mistake, quote unquote, that the music industry had to do in a way. Because they were forced. Like, they were in a situation where piracy was so big, they had to do something.
Well, wait a second. When I think about, like, the movie and the TV show industry, I think they're afraid of Apple. I think they're less worried about streaming. Maybe less so now that Netflix is such a prominent player. But, like, I think movie and TV shows are very, very afraid of Apple and of iTunes Store and of selling individual episodes. Like, they absolutely don't seem to want that. Or if they do, it's through Ultraviolet, which is... don't even get me started on fucking Ultraviolet. But
I would include that decision that the music industry had to make.
Definitely.
Like, it's part of the mistake that they did, quote unquote. Like, the TV industry sees it as a mistake, but I wouldn't say.
But it saved the industry. That's the thing. Like, exactly. iTunes saved the music industry, and the TV industry is like, what the hell? They got saved? We don't want any of that. Screw that.
I guess the thinking is more, we don't want to be in a situation where we need Apple to be saved.
Well, yeah. But, like, one of the things that immediately comes to mind about this is how the cable companies, which are often ISPs, are in bed with the content providers, naturally. Like, Comcast is NBC. Time Warner is, I forget the other one because I'm not very good at American cable companies, but, like...
And if we want to have a Canadian example, we have Rogers here.
Yeah, Rogers, Bell, and...
Videotron.
Cogeco. Yeah, they're all in bed with content providers. And it is not in their interest to have, like, Apple come along and say, hey, we want to make, like, Apple TV... the perfect cable cutter box. Like, they don't want to hear about cable cutting at all because they're cable companies. Like, it doesn't work. Like,
no, it does not. It does not. And it is kind of the same with cell phone providers, because now they are, like, data providers. And they are seeing, like, the need that people want to watch videos, want to listen to music via streaming services, but they also own media companies and...
Yeah, so that's sort of the mess that there is. I think there would be less of a mess if content providers were literally just TV channels and were not associated with cable companies. Like, I think we would have seen a lot more progress. But because now everyone is a cable company, we're seeing no progress whatsoever. And it's sort of disappointing. Like, when Tim Cook talks about the Apple TV and he says, like, TV hasn't changed since the 80s, well... One, he's wrong. It's actually gotten worse, because before you had like 3 channels and you could like just press channel up, channel down. Now you have to manage these stupid program guides that take forever to load and are ugly.
Yeah, and first of all, you have to wait for Java to load or Flash or Flex or whatever weird technology they're using to make that PBR
box.
It's
garbage.
It is.
So, like, when I hear Tim Cook say that, I know he's talking about like the TV UI, but in a way, like, the TV industry with regards to the companies that are in charge and everything has only gotten messier since the 80s. And now it's just, like, a giant mess that I don't think we can ever come out of it, really. I think it you need something like YouTube to disrupt the whole thing and to say, like, well, we don't need TV anymore because we just watch YouTube videos now, which that's another problem in itself, because I am not a big fan of most of the stuff on YouTube. But, yeah.
And another big example is Twitch. Like, we all know that people that are younger than us that love video games are always on Twitch.
Actually, I'm always on Twitch, and I'm not younger than we are.
Oh, I'm not on Twitch. Maybe that's because I'm not a big gamer then.
I don't know.
But my point here is Twitch is becoming TV for tons of people.
Yeah, like, I think Gruber, John Gruber, calls it, like, the ESPN of the current generation. Like, people are watching video games as our parents watched sports growing up, basically. And, like, esports, they call it esports for a reason, because it's just about as repulsive to watch esports as it is to watch real sports. Oh, sorry, I mean, because esports are just as credible sports as actual sports.
Oh, wow. You're going to have lots of tweets related to that comment.
I'm sorry.
Please email Yannick.
Basketball is cool, though. You can watch basketball. That sport is really good.
Yep. I guess we can... We need to end that episode on a positive note.
Really? We do?
Yeah.
But how? So,
I wanted to ask you something. Like, what do you like about streaming services? Like, any kind. Like, I mostly talk about music and TVs and movies. But there's tons of other streaming services I haven't touched. For example, book services, comic services. In the pre-show, you talk about PS Plus and PS Now, PlayStation Now, pardon me.
Yeah.
And all of those services. Like, what's attracting people to use those services? Because, like, if those services were invented, there's a reason why. And it's not to save the music industry from piracy. There's another, like, argument for them.
Right. So, when I joined Spotify, which I believe, was about like 2011-ish when I really got into it, I really liked the idea of listening to friends' playlists. Like, that's a great idea for me, because I don't know. There's something to, like, a playlist of related songs that have a thematic narrative or something that just speaks to me more than just, like, here is the entire discography of every artist ever. And that's part of the reason why Beats music sounds so interesting to me, but I can't use it because I'm in Canada. Weep. Otherwise, like, I haven't actually stuck to Spotify because, like, most of the music that I listen to isn't on there because I'm a weeb who likes Japanese music.
Sorry to interrupt, but the only way to get the kind of music you like is to just import CDs, right? There's no streaming services for those, for that kind of music, for that genre of music.
Right, for the most part, yeah. There are Japanese music streaming services, but they're mostly more on the pop side of things. Like, they're basically the music you would find in a Japanese version of Spotify, more or less, and the artists I listen to aren't even on major record labels, so they wouldn't be in that, necessarily. So, like, there's no real streaming option for me. I'm a big fan of SoundCloud because I am also on the side a DJ sometimes, and that is sort of what SoundCloud was made for. Namely, I really like finding remixes of songs I like or mashups of songs I like and listening to them there. And occasionally there will be a download button right there, and it'll be really great. I mentioned it earlier, Bandcamp. So Bandcamp is not a streaming service, though there are rumors that Bandcamp is testing a subscription service where you could actually go and say, hey, artist, I really like your music. I will pay you $10 per month to listen to your entire discography forever. And you can download it no DRM or listen to it in the app. That sounds like a pretty interesting model. Of course, major artists are not going to be on Bandcamp. It's mostly independent artists. I am happy that a lot of music I've discovered over the recent, like, 1 or 2 years have been available through Bandcamp. So I can do a lot of music purchasing via there, and I really, really like it. The only thing I dislike about it is there is no easy way for me on iOS to buy music directly on Bandcamp and then have it show up in my iTunes library. I still have to go back to my computer and put it in my iTunes library and then sync it over. So that's unfortunate because, of course, like, because I'm a DJ from time to time, I actually want it in the music library that's accessible to all the apps, because then I can actually spin with those songs as opposed to just listening to them. So that's pretty much what I do on the music side. On video, like YouTube, I said I wasn't a big fan of most content on YouTube. And like, what's unfortunate is as soon as you watch like one video game related thing on YouTube, your recommendations are ruined because it's all people who are screaming at video games.
Or just people playing video games and explaining to you what they're doing. Those videos I honestly don't understand.
Yeah, it's that. And then like if you watch too many of them, then you get like the crazy Gamergate conspiracy theory bullshit in your recommendations. And then I'm like, I'm disgusted at this. Can I just say YouTube never show me these videos? But no, you can't do that. Like, but there are a few channels that I actually enjoy. Like for Destiny, there's a channel, Dotto Does Destiny, that I absolutely love. It is like my favorite one because the guy is just like a normal dude and he's not yelling into a microphone or pretending to be like a TV star or whatever. Like the YouTube star stereotype is offensive to me because I think like those videos are garbage and I don't want to watch them.
Yeah, let's jump on that because I'm sure we'll be adding an hour on that podcast just speaking about the YouTube stars.
But I want to talk about like Netflix originals and Amazon Prime Video has originals as well, because I think like, what they're doing is probably what's most scary to movie studios and TV show people. Do you know more or less how those came about being?
Honestly, that's a good question. Like, I just know that at some point Netflix decided to make House of Cards. And
okay, but do you know how they came up with the idea for House of Cards?
Honestly, no.
Okay, so when you watch something on Netflix, Netflix knows when you pause, they know when you are watching things, when you drop off, so they actually know like what bits of TV shows are the most popular and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that would seem reasonable.
So then they can take like, oh, well, there are like people who watch Mad Men and they really like this kind of scene, and they also like this show which has this kind of scene, and they sort of like put together this graph of here are all the interrelated things that this particular kind of person would like, and then they make that show.
Right, and I remember that. And
that pisses off the TV show people because they don't get that data, but Netflix does, and then they go compete with them with that data.
Yeah, I think I read an article already that a couple of months ago. Like they use that data for some, I think some Battlestar Galactica. Like when they negotiate a price to get those series on Netflix, they were like, you know what? We have like 10,000 people that are currently watching the old seasons, and we know that because of XYZ and all of that data in our databases, will double, at least double, triple that number of subscribers if you add your new season.
Or like recently, Netflix, I believe it was Netflix, announced that they were going to be paying Adam Sandler to make like a bunch of movies that were going to be Netflix exclusives, which, okay, whatever, Adam Sandler.
Yeah, but whatever. Like,
apparently his movies are very, very popular on Netflix, which doesn't really surprise me because like,
yeah,
what else are you going to watch on Netflix?
Yeah, they are light comedy movies. So like, there's nothing to watch.
Let's watch this Adam Sandler movie.
I would say let's watch that light comedy movie. Not
like, yeah, well,
I would be really general here.
Yeah. Well, apparently like they only did that because they said like a bunch of people watch those movies and we don't understand why, but okay, we'll pay you to make those movies. That is really, really scary because it's sort of like if Spotify said, wow, a lot of people like Taylor Swift, maybe we should make our own country / pop singer that sings about her relationship problems that apparently never end. And they decided to do that, and then it got really popular, and then Taylor Swift would be like, well, what?
Are you sure that's going to be a problem? Because I don't think so. Maybe that's the capitalism in me that's talking right now, but if they want to survive, they need to find better ways than just streaming bytes. And one way that seems to make money and keep those company afloat is creating their own content. Or
no, but yeah, it makes sense.
Removing a barrier. Like I would say, like if Spotify or radio launches their own like record label, like come here and we'll like produce your music, we'll publish your music to our big database of users that love that kind of money. And not that kind of money, but that kind of music.
No, from a business perspective, it's genius, right? But from the opposite side, if you're actually talking from Taylor Swift's side, like you look at these streaming services and you're like, well, what's stopping Spotify from doing that? Like, do I really want to be contributing to these services that more or less at some point they will have to do something like this if they want to make themselves money, right? I don't see like how they can avoid that. Like, if the way forward is streaming, then it becomes a lot more appealing to services like Spotify to rip off what Netflix did and say, well, okay, we're launching our own original artists today.
Yeah, that would be a good move. A good business move. Maybe I'm not good
for Spotify, for the artists.
Like, all know that they have like a really nice goal of like making people consume and pay for music and then bring more music to artists. That's their goal as a business.
And like the thing about the Netflix originals is that I think now this is going to screw up negotiations next time they have to renew, like specifically TV series. Like, I don't think AMC is very thrilled about Netflix looking at Mad Men data to determine, well, maybe we should make a show that is sort of like Mad Men. And I believe they haven't, because I am a big fan of Mad Men, and I don't think anything on Netflix looks like Mad Men right now, other than Mad Men itself. But I think TV companies might actually back out of negotiations with Netflix and say, well, if you're going to be doing originals, we are not interested in being in our competitor's service, right? And then the TV selection on Netflix is going to gradually degrade. And then you basically only have Netflix originals, which is good for Netflix because Netflix has already paid for those originals. So more of their like subscription money every month is going to them instead of going to TV companies, right?
Yeah, exactly. But at that point, they need to be in a situation where they have a big catalog of original that their customer won't see that exode of normal providers.
Yeah, they need to hurry up and do it before their next negotiations, basically. Amazon's the same way.
Yeah, exactly. And I guess, like, maybe HBO is the best company for that. Is like the way that they transition from the old way of doing stuff, aka like being on TV, to move to the cable colors. Like, there's rumors that they are currently working with the MLB, like interactive company, the MLB part of the company that did the MLB app.
Right. To make their own. It's not like MLB, the baseball league. It's like they spun off the people who made the MLB app and the streaming system for that app. And now they basically do it for people on contract, basically.
Yes. But they put themselves where people want them to be. Because, like, the best example of that is Games of Thrones, most pirated TV show this year. I don't take that as a fact, but
Well, it probably is.
I'm not saying don't take that as a fact because I don't have the numbers.
It's still Top Gear, because Top Gear it used to be historically.
Yeah, exactly. But those kind of like specialized show, like Top Gear, like Games of Thrones, like Battlestar Galactica, and all of those sci-fi stuff. Like, if a company like Netflix is able to say, like, hey, content maker, we have 10 millions of people that would like to watch that kind of sci-fi series. Come here and make one. That's thumbs up for those 10 millions of people.
And the thing for HBO is, like, HBO can charge, like, let's say $10 a month. If they do that, they are making more money than they would have made selling one season of Game of Thrones on iTunes. But as a consumer, personally, what I would have rather done is go to iTunes, buy the season, because then I pay maybe $25 for the season, but then I don't have to pay anything else. And if I'm content with only watching that one show, then I got exactly what I wanted, right? It, what worries me is, like, when streaming services are the only way to get a certain bit of content, that pisses me off. Like, some things I just want to be able to buy it and own it forever and not have to think about it. Like, Mad Men is the only TV show that I watch anymore. Well, at least on Western TV. it's the only TV show I watch anymore. Like, there is no point in having a TV subscription for a bunch of channels. If all I watch is one series, I can just go buy Mad Men for, like, I think it's $30 on iTunes, and then I'm done. And it's a lot cheaper to be the $30 than it costs for even a month of satellite TV, right?
Yeah, but the problem is, if you try to watch more than one season, it's becoming...
It adds up quick, yes. I'm aware of the fact. But the thing is, like, I think most people realistically don't follow that many shows.
Yeah, you're right, because most of the time it's pretty hard to follow tons of shows.
Yeah.
You kind of, like, came by close to the all of those TV shows on the Eastern side that you're listening. Like, I'm sure, like, more the TV shows that we're referring to are Japanese TV series.
Yes.
And how do you get those TV shows or movies or, like, all of those content, like, visual content from Japan to here?
So there is a legal way to do it. It's called Crunchyroll. The problem is, and I could do an entire episode on the world of anime subtitles because that is a mess, but Crunchyroll, the problem is, they are the legal solution. They are the only legals. Well, no, there's actually Daisuki, which is another streaming service that launched, I believe, this year by Japanese anime companies who are trying to defeat anime piracy. The problem is their subtitles are shit.
But what do you mean by subtitles are shit? Like the translation or the...
Yeah. Okay. The translation is really, really bad. Like every week, I actually follow a couple of anime fan sub. Fan subs are the name for fan translations of anime. I follow fan subbers on Twitter. And every week there is like a screenshot of, look at this crazy Crunchyroll translation that makes no sense. And this happens basically every week. There is a pirate group called Horrible Subs, which basically just downloads the Crunchyroll subs and puts it in an MKV container for you to watch. So if you want the shows quickly, you can go download the Horrible Subs version and they will be there at the same time that they are in Japan. So that's actually the cool thing that Crunchyroll does, right? They sign deals with the anime companies to have the shows go live in the West at exactly the same time that they air in Japan. Sometimes you can even watch them on Crunchyroll before they air in Japan, which is strange.
But that's awesome for Westerners,
I guess, if you can live with the bad translations. So
yeah, but if you're someone like me that enjoys animes or Japanese TV shows but does not understand a word of Japanese, bad translation is fine.
No, but that's the thing. So you can actually go to various torrent websites and go download fan-translated versions of the exact same shows that are on Crunchyroll, except the translation quality is going to be better and you're not going to pay anything.
Yeah, but the problem is it takes time for those fans to create it, I guess.
Well, actually, you would be very surprised how fast fan subbers work.
Oh, wow. The way you answered that was like, I upset fan subbers now.
No, I didn't mean it that way. But, like, seriously, like, a half hour after an anime series has aired in Japan, there will be the raw on torrent websites. And then easily a couple hours afterwards, there will be a fan translation. It might not be the best fan translation. Some of them take a while. Some of them, many cases, people will lose interest midway through a series and then it's lost forever. So you're not guaranteed to get every episode, but... which might be a reason to go with Crunchyroll. But like the dedicated groups that have been out there for years, they usually like they'll stick by a series and do it the whole way through and in a very professional way within a very reasonable delay. I personally download unsubbed episodes. I've already touched on this. This is entirely not legal, but it's the only way I can get unsubbed anime, really. The other way is to use streaming services over VPN, which is not very recommendable if you want to watch videos.
Yeah.
Oh, the other thing I do is for stuff I want to watch live, you can go surf various Russian streaming websites that have very legal streams of Japanese TV stations and watch them through there.
So you're suddenly kind of forced to use quote-unquote legal stuff.
Like, seriously, give me a satellite box that can watch Tokyo MX and TV Asahi, and I will gladly hand over the money to watch those channels, but I can't because they are not available here.
And that's strange. Like, recently, like a year ago, I had to move cable provider, and I was like, just for the fun of it, going through their list of international channel, and they don't have tons of stuff. Like, they do have tons of U.S. shows and, U.S. channels. But when you start to go to Europe, Japan,
usually what you'll get is, like, NHK World, which is, like, their version of BBC World Service, where it's, like, here's the international news in English from Japan. But, like, that's not what I want. I want, like, the actual shows that are airing on broadcast TV. I want Tokyo MX. I want Nitere, I want TV Asahi, and I know those. It's so stupid, but I know the program grids for those TV stations better than I know the ones here. Like,
yeah, but the reason why I did that a year ago was I was like, oh, maybe I could, like, a good way to start relearning small Swedish I learned while I was in Sweden was like watching Swedish TV, but nah.
Well, you can go watch a bunch of stuff on the SVT website. That's what I did.
That's what I didn't end up to do, but if at least I was like paying for something and looking at my bill every month, I like, and my bill is nagging me like, you haven't watched Swedish TV this month and you're paying for it, so you should do something like watching Swedish TV. Maybe it would have helped, but but the point I was trying to make is most of the international channels are Middle East channel. Like, there's a ton of Al Jazeera and Egyptian TV, Chinese TV, but nothing Korean, nothing Japanese, nothing related, like, nothing like North of Europe, nothing France, a little bit Spanish TV, but maybe
it's
a channel or two.
It's surprising there's not Korean, because Korean dramas are really, really popular.
They are, but even then, the number of European channels was so small that I was really surprised. Yeah. Especially compared to the number of Middle East channels.
Maybe we should get back on topic a little bit. let's talk a bit about video games. PlayStation Plus comes to mind about this, and it's not technically a streaming service because you are downloading the games onto your service, but the idea is pretty simple. You pay, I believe, $9.99 a month, and you get a variety of advantages and perks. One of them is online multiplayer on the PS4, which used to be free on the PS3, but is now paid. You get automatic updates on PS3, which, hallelujah, because the PS3 would always ask you to make an update before playing anything if you didn't have Plus. Save games in the cloud, which back up automatically, which is brilliant, because if you lose your Vita or something, you can just pick them back up from the cloud.
It is brilliant, except when you haven't being a PS Plus member and have save games and you want to upload them. It's like still confusing to me, but yeah, that might be only me.
But another weird thing about PS Plus is you get 6 free games a month. You get 2 PS4 games, 2 PS3 games, and 2 Vita games a month, which are free for the duration of your subscription. So as long as you are subscribed, those games are playable to you. But you have to add them to your library during that month, which is sort of a confusing system. So what that basically means is Dukadivya doesn't have a PS4, But he can go into the PlayStation Store on his PS3 and say, hey, those two PS4 games, I want to add them to my library. And then if he keeps his PS Plus subscription until he gets a PS4, then when he gets his PS4, all of those games will be playable from his PS4, which is actually pretty neat. And that is why a bunch of people I know actually bought PS4s, because they had stockpiled a bunch of free PS4 games beforehand. And then when they had enough that they wanted to play, they just bought the PS4 and had all the free games loaded up for it already. Which is neat, except it poses the question, how the hell are they paying developers?
That's a good one. That's honestly a good one. I'm sure Sony's taking like hardware profits to like finance that service, because the price is lower than $9.99. It's $4.99 per month, and if you're paying yearly, it's $60 per year.
Yeah,
so it's really cheap. You get at least 6 games. Like, let's say if you only have like a PS3 and you only take those two, you get 24 games per year. For the price of one.
Yeah. It's kind of nuts.
It is nuts.
They actually changed their thing a little bit when the PS4 came out, because before they were doing, I think it was still 6 or 8 games spread across PS3 and Vita. So I think there were like 2 PS1 titles and then a mishmash of PS3 and Vita titles. When they brought the PS4 out, they streamlined it. They said 2 PS4, 2 PS3, 2 Vita, made it very clear that it was going to be like that going forward.
And also, I think they changed the like 6 months ago, they changed the way they want the duration of those. Like you said, it's 1 month, and before that they had long running titles that were always available freely for PS Plus members. Like, one example is Uncharted on Vita that I wanted to buy, to try, and to just download using PS Plus, and then bought it a week ago, and it was like, oh, wow, Uncharted is not there anymore. And did some research, and they told I think I found some weird article on Wikipedia that was saying that, yeah, it was part of those games that were long-running free games or PS Plus members, but Sony decided to stop doing that.
Yeah, and they're still doing that in Japan. It's just like in America where they decided, no, let's stop doing that. So that's PS Plus. The big question, of course, is how are they paying developers? I'm not entirely sure on the answer to that question. I do know that there are a lot more indie games in the rotation now than there used to be, so they probably actually just go for lower cost games than they used to, because like before they used to have like big AAA games in there.
And it also helped their cause, because as we know with the PS4 and with the PS Vita, Sony is really big on indie devs.
Yeah.
And that helped them a lot.
Yeah. And what I hear from a lot of people who are subscribed to PS Plus, like before they were doing it really for the big AAA games to get them for free, because why not? But a lot of people are saying, hey, I'm discovering a lot of games that I get through PS Plus that I wouldn't have known about or tried otherwise. And now at least they're getting a little money from me, whether I play it or not, really, I guess. So that's cool. The other streaming service that I wanted to bring up with regards to video games is PlayStation Now, which is also by Sony. It's currently in beta on PS4, PS3, PS Vita, and Bravia TVs.
What?
Yeah, you can actually just buy a DualShock and link it with your Bravia TV if you have one, and play PlayStation Now games directly on a Bravia TV with no console.
Oh, that's pretty neat.
I also forgot to mention PlayStation TV, which, yeah.
Yeah, you said PlayStation Vita, so.
Yeah, I know. But I wanted to remind people that that existed.
Have you tried PlayStation Now? Because I haven't had the opportunity to try it. Mostly because I don't think there's any games I want to stream.
Yeah, so that's sort of the problem, right? So PlayStation Now, for those who are not familiar with the thing, is based on Gaikai, which is a service that Sony acquired, I think it was 2 years ago. That technology is also the basis for the PS4's Remote Play, which I have previously mentioned on the episode where I talked about having the PS4 and playing PS4 games on the PS Vita within the house, and it was great. This is basically the same thing, except instead of playing on a PS4, you're playing on a PS3 in a data center somewhere. And it looks really exciting. The problem is that the lineup of games isn't great because it's mostly like old PS3 titles, but B-tier PS3 titles that not that many people want to play. The only thing that really stood out to me as wanting to play is what's it called? Lost Planet 2. Was it 2 or 3? I think it was 3. I really want to play that, but otherwise nothing else really jumps off. There was Final Fantasy 13 and 13.2 on there as well.
Yeah, and like rumors a couple of years ago before that service went beta was that Sony planned to use that service to do backward compatibility on the PS4.
Yeah, and that actually I want to sort of mention that. So the way it sounded to people before it actually came out in beta was that games you had digitally purchased on the PlayStation Store on the PS3 would magically appear as PlayStation Now games on the PS4, and you could play them directly there. That is not the case at all, at least not during the beta. Things can still change, but right now during the beta, you are doing basically rentals.
Yeah, it is rental. I think it is Sony's take on the like video games rental store.
Yeah, it's like what's it called? Gamefly? Does that still exist? Basically, what Gamefly was, where it was basically the Netflix DVD service, but for games. Well, it's like that, except fully digital. It makes sense to some extent. There were some rumors also of it being a subscription service where you would pay sort of like Netflix $9.99 a month and then get a library of games you can play indefinitely via streaming. I don't know if that's tenable. I really wouldn't like to see it go that way, but whatever.
And I think OnLive is that way.
OnLive doesn't exist anymore. It hasn't existed for years.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What?
But yeah, that's what it was.
Oh, really? Oh, wow. Oh, wow. Okay.
So that tells you how tenable that was.
Let's rewind a bit and forget that I said that.
Yeah. It looks pretty impressive. Again, the primary reason I haven't played with it is just the games that I want to play aren't really there. What's strange, very, very strange, is there are a lot of fighting games in their library, and like I play fighting games from time to time, and fighting games are not the kind of game that where lag or latency is very tolerable. In fact, it ruins the game. So it's very strange that like a bunch of fighting games are in there. There's BlazBlue, there's Street Fighter, there's I'm forgetting all of them, but yeah, there are a lot of fighting games in there.
And it's part of why I haven't tried that service yet.
Well, honestly, I would just rather, if there was a fighting game I really liked, I would rather just buy it directly on the console than play it over streaming because of how fragile that would seem.
Yeah.
Like, I wouldn't want to play a tournament game on that, basically.
And also, have you tried the, have you tried running the internet test?
Connection test?
Yeah, connection test. Yeah,
it doesn't actually say much. It just says, well, your connection is great for this. Okay.
Okay, so your connection was at least okay for it. Are great.
Yeah,
I don't remember the word they use. But
one of the problems that they have with PlayStation Now is you can actually pass that connection test, get into a game, and then if the game is not playable, you have no real recourse to say I want my money back or anything like that, which is sort of a problem.
Yeah. But I guess right now they're using the better term to just forget about that.
Yeah, which is sort of unfortunate. My hope is that eventually, sometime before Gran Turismo 7 comes out, PlayStation Now will let me play digitally purchased PlayStation 3 games on my PS4 and on my Vita, and I will be able to play Gran Turismo 6 on my Vita, and will be happy. Honestly, that would be the best thing ever.
Oh my. Gran Turismo 6 on the PS Vita.
Honestly, that's the reason I haven't actually gotten that far. Well, I beat GT6, but I would like to actually go in and do more races. The problem is I don't want to sit in front of a TV to do it. So if you could get it to me on Vita, it would be perfect.
good. And I think that was mostly what I wanted to say about streaming services. I guess I'll end on that note, which is I do love those services, and I think there's a future for them, but I don't think the future, that the way that they work right now is where they will be in 5-10 years. And I'm sure there's brilliant people, that might be us, that might be somebody we know, that will find solution for them. And I'm sure that they will stick around.
But in the apocalyptic future, maybe there are no more music companies, no more movie companies, no more entertainment of any kind. And we are all just bored all the time.
Okay, I wanted to end that episode on a positive note.
Actually, free-to-play games will ruin everything, and that's all I have to say.
Is that your segment related to your topic about the next episode?
Probably, actually.
Oh, wow. Nice segue, by the way.
Yeah, so next week, probably going to be talking about free-to-play games. I've been teasing that I've had my notes ready for this episode since before episode one was recorded. So maybe next week I will finally get to talk about free-to-play games.
And it will be really topical, because as everyone knows right now, there's like the PSN holiday sale, and I'm sure Steam will have their big holiday sale. So it's like time to play video games.
Yeah. So look forward to that in 2 weeks.
So before we close out the show, last week we mentioned that we're about to end season one. And I would like to mention that we're in the last two episodes of season one. So we should end in 4 weeks. So mid-January. And we'll end with one of my topics that is still a secret right now.
That's nice. So if you want to find out where our show notes are, well, let me tell you. Our show notes are located at limitlesspossibility.net/5. That is /5 because of episode 5, which is this week's episode.
Do you want to tell our listener in French how to go to our show notes then?
No, I don't.
Oh, I'm sad.
You can follow us on Twitter. Our show is at @limipo_podcast. That's @limipo_podcast on Twitter. We have a website. It's limitlesspossibility.net. I am on Twitter as @Sakurina. That's SAKURINA. And you are?
@LUCONUCHE. And that's @Lukonush.
And we will see you in 2 weeks.
Yeah. See you in 2015.
Actually, it won't be 2015 yet.
Oh, it will be. It will be.
It will?
Yes.
God damn.
I was right.
Okay, we'll see you in 2015.
See you next year.